In the year 1945, as World War II was drawing to a close, the balance of power militarily had shifted in favor of the Allied forces. Adolf Hitler, seeing the handwriting on the wall, as it were, took his own life. I want you now to try to project yourself, if you can, into the future to the year AD 4000. Quite a long time from now. Hard to imagine what the world's going to be like if it still exists that far down the line. But I want you to imagine that in the year 4000, archaeologists dig up a copy of the life of Adolf Hitler, and that biography of Hitler is very complimentary. It portrays him as a hero, someone who had deeper insight into the things that matter than most people, and what he stood for and what he was defending and what he was trying to accomplish in his life was admirable. Just simply, he was misunderstood by those of his own generation. And based on further investigation, it comes to light that this copy of the account of Hitler's life actually dated to the year 2250, still almost 300 years into our future. So if you get the picture we're drawing here, this account of Hitler's life was written about 300 years after he lived. No one knew who the author of this particular work was. And that work, 300 years after he lived, is not discovered for another 1,700 years. Now, why are we thinking about Adolf Hitler, you might be wondering? Because the principle that you see on the screen in hypothetical form really reflects what's going on with the discovery of the Gospel of Judas. And I've changed what I'm doing a little bit today. If you were expecting a different sermon from the bulletin Wednesday night, as I got to digging into this for the evening sermon, I just came across more things I wanted to get into than I had time for. So I don't know what you call this. Usually what I do is called a gospel sermon. This is the anti-gospel sermon. We're usually preaching about the Bible. We're preaching about not the Bible, as it were, today. This morning, I'd like to focus on the Gospel of Judas itself and point out some things to you about that work. And then tonight, we're really going to sort of back up and look at the bigger picture of the canonicity of the Bible. It's a big fancy word. It just means how was the Bible collected and put into the form that we recognize today as the 66 books that are therein, but more specifically the 27 that make up the New Testament. So that's where we're going in the lesson today. Well, let me point out some things to you. Oops, I forgot that. Let me point out some things to you about the Gospel of Judas. This has created quite a stir, quite a bit of hoopla, and perhaps has raised some questions in the minds of some Christians that they might not have a very good answer to. But as we dig in a little bit more into this particular subject, note with me just some historical details about this work, this supposedly biographical work that dates past, actually, the life of Judas. It was written by an unknown author. That is, the Gospel of Judas itself. There's no identification as to who may have written this. The date at which it would have been written is also unknown. Irenaeus denounced it as a heretical writing in A.D. 180. So apparently the original Gospel of Judas is in existence at that time, but it's unknown as to exactly when it would have been written. The manuscript that has now recently come to light, it's not the original, as is in the case of the New Testament books. We don't have the originals of those. What we have to look at and examine are copies. But what's been found recently is a copy of the Gospel of Judas that dates somewhere between 230 and 330 AD. So you can see from our illustration of Adolf Hitler, It's a copy that comes quite a bit later, obviously in the life of Judas, but from the original Gospel of Judas, whoever may have produced that. Between 15 and 25%, some estimates are even more, 15 to 25% of the Gospel is missing. And I'm going to give you some examples of that a little bit later in the lesson. The manuscript that is being published now was found in an unknown cave, an unknown location in Egypt. Speculation is that it was part of something called the Nag Hammadic Library, and that refers to a group of writings that were Gnostic in origin, and we'll have a couple of things to say about that. But let me show you an example. I don't know if anybody saw the National Geographic special. I'd like to thank Freeman and Priscilla for downloading that and recording it for me, and I was able to watch it before the lesson. But this was on a week or two ago. And as I sat with a couple of the kids, particularly Lauren, and we went through the video of that program, it was not surprising, but astounding how much speculative language was used in that. And by the way, if you've not picked up on that, so many documentaries that we might watch, especially scientific documentaries, and a documentary on a find like this, train yourself to listen very closely to actually what is being said. Because you're going to find scholars think, it's possible, might be, approximately. You're going to find indefinite references through many documentaries that are put out in the public arena as being truth or being based on scientific investigation. Train yourself to listen for that. But let me give you an example of that in regard to where the Gospel of Judas was found. This is a typical statement. After admitting that they didn't know, because the farmer apparently that originally found the gospel was afraid of the black market forces, that somebody might actually try to kill him. So when they went trying to find the person who actually found this manuscript, the guy wouldn't identify himself. But after wild speculation, here was their conclusion. It all seems to add up. The Nag Hammadi Library and the Gospel of Judas appear to have been written at about the same time and were found in roughly the same place. That is a quote. Real scientific, isn't it? You want to know how they got to this conclusion in the program, if you saw it? They started digging around in some caves where they thought the manuscript might have been found, and they found some pottery, broken pottery. And on it was Coptic writing, which is what the Gospel of Judas was originally written in, and that's Egyptian. It's an old form of Egyptian, Coptic writing. And they said, look, we found some caves with some pottery with Coptic writing. We think the Gospel of Judas may have been found in this area. You want to know what that's like? Let's go to the year 4000 AD again, and let's imagine that the Atlanta that we know today is buried in rubble and in dust and dirt and lots of Georgia clay is piled on top of it. And they're trying to find a particular bank in which a document has been found in the year 4000. They're tracing it to the year 2006. And they start digging in an area where they think this document might have come from a particular bank. And they dig in that location and they find some other documents that are written in English. And they say, you know what, we think that document must have come from a bank in this area because we found another document and it's in English. What else would these documents have been in but Coptic, since it was the language of the day at that time? That's the stuff that's thrown out in these documentaries, and unsuspecting people go, yeah, that makes sense to me, same language. We really need to pay attention to the experts when they start telling us how things are. The Gospel of Judas regarding its content does reflect heavily Gnostic teaching. May or may not have been from the time of the Nag Hammadi Library, but nonetheless, there are explicit statements in the Gospel of Judas that strongly will demonstrate, and again, I'll give you an example in a minute, strong examples of Gnostic thinking. And at certain times in lessons in the past, we've mentioned Gnostics, and I did some lessons on Colossians a while back, and we talked about some things that apparently what's called incipient Gnosticism. That just means Gnosticism in its embryonic or its early forms was apparently present in the first century. It does not develop as a clear theology until later, but there are certain things said in the New Testament that sure sound like the writers are aware of some Gnostic tendencies. And so they're writing to defend against this heresy that's not yet full grown, but by inspiration they can see it coming on the horizon. Gospel of Judas is very definitely Gnostic in several things that are said. Judas is portrayed as having a deeper insight than the other apostles, which is a key principle of Gnosticism. This is a group of supposedly Christians who thought they had found something deeper, something more subtle, something more insightful than just the average people that go by the Bible. We've come to experience God inwardly. And so Gnostic means knowledge, gnosis, from the Greek term gnosis. And these are people that put a lot of emphasis, not on studying the Bible knowledge, but on intuitive knowledge. And guess what? In the Gospel of Judas, Judas is portrayed as having deeper insight than the other apostles. He understood things that they did not. Jesus told Judas in the Gospel of Judas that he would be greater than the other apostles, though he would be persecuted by them. In fact, what a large part of this gospel is based on is supposedly a secret conversation that Jesus had with Judas 3 days before the Passover. I don't know when Judas was able to communicate this conversation to someone, because as we've read in our scripture this morning, he dies before Jesus does. So that brings up an interesting question as to how knowledge of this conversation that Jesus supposedly had with Judas came to light. But nonetheless, this is like Adolf Hitler being recorded in glowing terms and having great insights when the literature of the contemporaries of Adolf Hitler would have had quite a different account of his life. Now, stepping away just a moment from the Gospel of Judas itself, let me show you what liberal theological principles do to the Bible and how they would venerate something as heretical as the Gospel of Judas. Again, these are not legitimate points. This is from the standpoint of liberal theology. Number one, liberal theology says that the original stories about Jesus were oral and thus subject to exaggeration, speculation, and error. They look back at the oral traditions of Jesus and subject that oral tradition and communication to all of the flaws and failures of the average human being. They say, as was said several times in the National Geographic documentary, there were many Christianities early on and many Gospels existed. Actually, scholars deny that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They say that those Gospels were actually written after those men died and their names were attached to them. But what they're trying to say simply is, early on, there were competing ideas, different brands or flavors of Christianity that sort of coexisted, and eventually by politics and by other things, one of these strains naturally came to the forefront. And so what's actually being said is that Christianity is the product of evolution. Christianity evolved from early oral traditions. Then later some things were put into writing after the fact. And then just gradually, one of these dominant accounts came to be accepted as what we know today as Christianity. I've already made that point. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were not actually written by either eyewitnesses, in the case of Matthew and John, or associates of the eyewitnesses in the case of Mark and Luke, but these were written later and attributed to these men. What is further said by liberal theology about the early writings of Christianity in regard to Judas is this. Mark, Matthew, and John, which is the chronological order that most scholars would put the books in, Mark being first, Mark, Matthew, and John tell increasingly negative stories about Judas. And this is where the story of the Gospel of Judas becomes scandalous and blasphemous. What's being said essentially is early Christians deliberately chose a gospel or wrote a gospel that was anti-Semitic, that is anti-Jewish. Hard to imagine why Jews would do that. But they wrote the gospels from the standpoint of being condemning toward the Jewish people in order to deflect attention away from themselves because of the persecutions that were beginning to come upon them. And so what is being said about Judas is he's deliberately made the scapegoat. He's made to look as bad as possible in an increasing light. As each one of these Gospels came to light, it had a worse picture of Judas in it. In order to cast aspersions on the Jewish people as a whole, and that was in order to deflect attention away from Christians because of persecution. In fact, in the National Geographic documentary, there was actual footage of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in World War II, and statements to the effect that the reason World War II happened and the reason for the Jewish Holocaust really finds its roots in the Christian story of the crucifixion of Jesus and the vilification of Judas and the attachment of guilt not only to Judas but by extension to all the Jewish people. And thus Adolf Hitler picked up on that and persecuted the Jews, and thus began World War II. It's not difficult really to see how that kind of reasoning comes about. If you want to find a way to destroy Christianity, well, take their texts and reinterpret them as you will and attach evil motives to them, and voila, you have Nazism and World War II laid at the feet of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Gnostics and their community, their thought, are portrayed in a positive light in the Gospel of Judas. Wherein, actually, when you begin to look at Gnostic teaching, they believed, came to believe over time that the serpent in the garden was actually good because he was trying to expand the knowledge of Eve, and that's what they stand for, is expanded knowledge. Jehovah in the Old Testament was an evil being and not the Creator. Jesus is not, in fact, divine in His nature, but a lesser aeon, A-E-O-N, a lesser being created by the Creator to thus bring things into existence, but He cannot be God in the flesh because the Gnostics held the flesh to be evil, and God can have no intimate contact with evil, thus Jesus was not God in the flesh, and other things. And so Gnostic heresy in the Gospel of Judas is held up as admirable and mainstream and what Christians ought to be striving for. Here's an example from the Gospel of Judas. I'm going to notice a couple of excerpts with you, and I'm going to tell you at the outset, I don't know how well you can see this, it's very difficult to read, and I'll show you as we go along. And I'm not real familiar yet with how things are or why things are the way they are. You'll notice occasionally numbers and brackets. I'm not sure what those are. It could be verse divisions. I don't know. But I'm not familiar with what those are. And then you'll notice some either an ellipsis, dot, 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 in brackets. Or you'll notice a word or part of a word in brackets. And I think those are being supplied as best as able from the damaged condition of the manuscripts as they exist today, or the manuscript as it exists today. Here's a passage. Stop, sack, and then in the bracket, sacrificing would be supplied. And then apparently some other words with the ellipsis that are not intelligible. Stop sacrificing, perhaps, which you have. And then there's a section unreadable. Over the altar, since they are over your stars and your angels and have already come to their conclusion there. So let them be, and again the word apparently supplied because it's fairly illegible, ensnared before you, and let them go. And then there's 15 lines missing after that. And then the word generations, and then some either missing or unintelligible words. A baker cannot feed all creation. Under heaven is supplied. And then more illegible. And then to them, and more illegible. And illegible to us, and illegible. And here's another example. Jesus said to them, and I didn't pick the worst examples. This is just typically the way the thing reads. Jesus said to them, stop struggling with me. Each of you has his own star, and every, perhaps, body. And then about 17 lines are missing. In, ellipsis, missing. Who has come, something, spring. For the tree, something. Of this aeon, something. For a time, something. But he has come to water God's paradise and the generation that will last, because he presumably will not defile the walk of life of, supposedly, that generation, but something, and then for all eternity. Let me ask you a question after just reading those brief excerpts. Why does the Gospel of Judas read like this? I mean, obviously things are missing, but what's the bigger picture here? The bigger picture is this. There's only one copy. That's what's recently come to light. That copy is not written by Judas himself, but by disciples of an apostate sect, that's Gnosticism, over 100 years, it's undefinable, but somewhere over 100 years after Judas lived. Now let me ask you another question. Why doesn't the Bible read like the Gospel of Judas reads? And the answer to that basically is because there are thousands, not one, there are thousands of manuscripts, as well as millions of Bible versions, uninspired quotations, and other sources that give a complete account of New Testament works that can be cross-checked one against the other. And when the term is used, manuscripts, in this context, it means a copy of a biblical book. That's what a manuscript is. It doesn't just mean some old writing. It means here is a copy of the Gospel of John that's come down the line. And again, let me emphasize, there aren't any originals of the Bible books either left. All we have, and somebody might say, well, you know, why are you knocking the Gospel of Judas? It's a copy. But all you have in the Bible, that's just copies too. Yes, the Bible that we read comes from copies of the original books. And there are thousands and thousands of manuscripts, actual copies of those New Testament books that were made and found, in spite of, I might add, great attempts on the part of humanity to destroy them all. God has seen fit to preserve not just His Word, but a cross-check referencing of His Word. That's why we don't read a few words in the Bible and then there's just something missing. And a few other words, and there's something missing. And 17 lines are missing. And we sort of guessed maybe what was in between. To say the Gospel of Judas is a copy, a manuscript, and that's no different from the Bible, is not an accurate statement. The Bible is copiously verified and substantiated by the cross-referencing of really millions of references that can be supplied, but thousands of Bible manuscripts themselves. Let me give you a side-by-side example, this in regard, and you can turn to Matthew 26 if you'd like. We'll read from there in just a moment. It'll be on the screen as well, but Matthew 26 is page 669 in the Pew Bible. Here's an example of the Gospel of Judas on the left side of the screen. And this has to do with Judas himself. Jesus said, truly I say, perhaps to you, this baptism, something, my name, and then there's nine lines missing and then something to me. Truly, I say to you, Judas, perhaps those who offer sacrifices to Sackless, God, and then three lines are missing after that, and then the observation, everything is evil. But you will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me. Now, if you haven't done a lot of research or reading in Gnosticism, that last statement may not mean anything to you, but it's a classic statement of Gnostic teaching. And what it has to do with is the fact that there's this outer body that's considered to be intrinsically evil. And it, for a time, housed the spirit of the Son of God, which came after His birth and left before His death. And you see this kind of reference here, you will sacrifice the man that clothes me. Jesus never spoke of Himself in those terms. He never denigrated His humanity in any way. But I want you to notice also in this passage is the notation to Judas exceeding them all. And what you see in this reference is the idea that Jesus told Judas to turn him in. That this was something that was admirable for Judas to do because it actually liberated Jesus from his sinful body. And thus, according to the Gnostic understanding of things, Judas becomes a hero. He's the only one that really understood the true nature of Jesus and liberated or freed Jesus by his betrayal. Well, beside that, let's look at Matthew 26, verses 24 and 25. This is during the institution of the Lord's Supper. Jesus says in verse 24, "The Son of Man goes as it is written of Him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born." Then Judas, who was betraying Him, answered and said, "Rabbi, is it I?" He said to him, "You have said it." I want you to also turn to the book of Acts chapter 1 and let's note something else said in reference to prophecy about Judas. Acts chapter 1 and verse 20, page 733 in the Pew Bible. This is the account of the replacement of Judas by Matthias. And it says in verse 18, "This man purchased a field with the wages of iniquity, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his entrails gushed out." I'll say something about that in a minute. "And it became known to all those dwelling in Jerusalem, so that field is called in their own language Akeldama, that is, the field of blood. For it is written in the book of Psalms, 'Let his habitation be desolate, and let no one live in it, and let another take his office.'" And I highly suspect, though I don't know that I could prove it, that what happens on this occasion is something that's been directed by the Lord. It's not Peter acting unilaterally and, "Hey, I've got a good idea, let's replace Judas." Since earlier on in Acts chapter 1, it says Jesus spent 40 days with them teaching them things concerning the kingdom, I would think that replacing Judas would have been one of those things that Peter was told to do. But here's the point. What do we do with this argument that says the gospel writers just sort of made this up about Judas, and the more they wrote, it just the story got worse about him? They made Judas look worse and worse and worse because they wanted to deflect attention away from themselves and put the blame for the death of Jesus on the Jews. One of the answers to that kind of a ridiculous explanation is what happened in regard to Judas is prophesied. It's prophesied in the Old Testament that the Lord would be betrayed by one of His close associates. Jesus referred to it in Matthew 26. And now the replacement of Judas is being referred to by prophecy in Acts chapter 1. That does not square with the explanation that the disciples made up the story about Judas. Secondly, what I want you to realize is Jesus Himself calls Judas's actions a betrayal. And somebody might say, "No, wait a minute. You know, these apostles and the gospel writers, well, they just made up those stories. And they cast things in a very positive light. Let me ask you a question. How would you prove that? How would you prove that that's the case? Well, I suppose if you could go back and you could find early manuscripts of gospels that portrayed Judas in a more positive light, and then you found later manuscripts of the gospels that portrayed him in a negative light, you might have an argument that over time the story of Judas changed. But you know what? You can't do that. Because there aren't any manuscripts, there aren't any accounts that portray Judas positively, and then gradually he slips into a negative light. I'm going to tell you, Jesus and the apostles, contemporaries of Judas, knew exactly the nature of Judas himself, and they knew the nature of his action, and it was not heroic, it was considered to be betrayal. Jesus says in Matthew 26, "Woe to that man." It's Son of Man goes as is, it's written of him. This is, you know, part of the plan and purpose of God, but personal responsibility is still operative. Woe to that man by whom it happens. And how ridiculous it would have been if the events were predestined by God. That's predetermined by God. And Judas really didn't have a choice in the matter. How ridiculous for Jesus to try to get Judas to change his mind, if he can't, in fact, change his mind. But Jesus does try to get Judas not to do what he goes ahead and does. Just as God tried to get Cain not to do what he went ahead and did in murdering his brother. In John chapter 6, look at how Jesus terms the coming betrayal. Page 719 in the Pew Bible, John chapter 6 and verse 70. After Peter's great, encouraging acknowledgement, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have come to believe and know that you're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said, "Thanks a lot, Peter. I really appreciate you recognizing that." Jesus answered and said in verse 70, "Did I not choose you, the 12, and one of you is a devil?" We already read in the reading earlier, Satan entered Judas. Greed being the likely motive. Judas is doing the work of the devil in betraying the Lord. That is not a concocted story out of an anti-Semitic viewpoint. These are Jews writing. And all this is an attempt to undermine the integrity of the Scriptures. One other point on that. If we can impugn the description of Judas, what are we going to believe in the Gospels or the Epistles or Luke's Acts? What are we going to believe that these men wrote? We ought not to believe anything, especially about Jesus, since Jesus himself is being impugned by these men. There's nothing really left to believe if we allow liberal and modern theology to define these events. Well, why is all of this important? Why are we spending some lessons on this? Well, it's not that particularly with this audience that's assembled, though I don't know all of you and can't speak for every single person who's here this morning. But generally speaking, I would assume that the Gospel of Judas is probably not going to change the way most of us would think about the Bible as a whole. I don't think we're going to come to see Judas as a hero. I don't think we're going to come to see the betrayal as something noble. What does concern me about this kind of attention that's being placed on this new archaeological, well, actually it's not a new find. It's been around for a long time. It's just newly come to light. What is troubling to me potentially is there might arise other questions like, can I really trust the Bible? Do we really have all the books of the Bible? Were there just a lot of politics going on in the first and early second centuries that determined why some books were included in the official canon account, as it were, of what was happening? Or do we really have an accurate assemblage of works? Last fall, Marty Pickup came and did a great, great series of lessons on the Bible as we have it now, and the manuscripts, and the evidence, and the archaeology, and the history behind it all. If you found that to be somewhat tedious, let me ask you this question. Do you feel equipped to answer the critics of the Bible relative to the Gospel of Judas? I mean, when Marty was here and preaching those lessons, might it not have been tempting for some to say, I don't know why we need this. I know what the Bible is, and I have confidence in the Bible. I don't need to go back and look at all this manuscript stuff and written in Greek, and this is uncial, and this is... There are people in this world, some of them who are theologians, many of them who are theologians, who are trying their dead level best to destroy the credibility of the Bible. How confident do you feel? Not in what you believe, I don't question that, but in your ability to defend the Scriptures as they exist. And I don't mean just necessarily against a critic. I mean against that voice in the back of your mind that says, well, I wonder if something was left out. I wonder if something was changed somewhere else. I mean, actually, can we be sure? This has been so long. Can we be sure we've got all the books? Was something put in there that shouldn't have been? We're going to talk about that tonight. Was something put in the Bible that shouldn't have been? After all, you know, we have these discussions about who wrote the book of Hebrews. We don't know who wrote the Gospel of Judas. So we don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. So what are we going to do with Hebrews? Does it belong in there? And then the broader question really would be this. What do you believe at all? I mean, the truth is, we're basing our life here upon the earth as Christians. We're basing our eternal hope. We're basing our value system. We're basing a sense of what we understand to be the truth. We're basing that on ancient writings. That's what we're basing it on. And it's those ancient writings that tell us about Jesus, about whom we've been singing and reflecting on His death this morning. The only source of information about Jesus that we really have any detail about is the Bible. And in the Gospel of Judas, what we have is not so much a threat in and of itself. What we have is aspersions being cast against the Scriptures and against the person of Jesus Christ. So, what do you believe in? What is your standard? What is your basis? What are you willing to face death on because you're convinced and convicted that it's right and true? I think we've got every reason in the world to be confident in the Scriptures as we have them today. That they tell the truth about Jesus, and they tell the truth about Judas, and they tell the truth about life here as a child of God and eternal life in the family of God forever and ever. What do you believe in? Can it be undermined by men? Will a new philosophy set it at naught? What's really worth giving your life here on the earth to, and what's worth dying for? And if you believe that that's Jesus Christ and you've never obeyed the gospel, the invitation is extended to you. We'll be happy to stay. It's raining and nasty outside. A few more minutes inside in a nice, dry, comfortable environment, and watching somebody become a child of God is a wonderful thing. And we're happy to stay as long as we need to. Is there any other way we can help you while we're standing and singing?